Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 33.
Well, Pigsy's in a bit of a weird spot.
A very weird spot. He's been captured, which, okay, happens. But the demons decide he's basically useless.
Like, utterly useless. And their plan for him is, well, it's pickling. They're going to pickle Pigsy.
Yeah, get this, pickling. It's this amazing mix of, like, high fantasy danger and just really mundane, almost kitchen-level problem-solving.
It's darkly funny, isn't it? Like, what do you do with a useless pig demon you accidentally caught?
Apparently, you save him for snacks later. It's quite the detail.
Definitely.
Pigsy. He gets separated, bumps into the Silverhorn demon, and, well, that's that. He's caught.
Hauled back to the cave. Lotus Cave, right?
And the head demon, Goldhorn, takes one look and just goes, nah, useless.
That's almost efficient in a demonic sort of way. They're focused on Tripitaka, the main prize.
Pigsy's just collateral damage, or maybe just inconvenient.
And Pigsy, oh my God, Pigsy hears this useless thing and actually tries to lean into it.
He does. He's like, yeah, useless, that's me. So you should probably just, you know, let me go.
But nope, no release. The demons have plan B.
Plan B, pickling, for future enjoyment.
While Pigsy's contemplating his vinegary future, what's happening with Tripitaka?
Tripitaka's starting to feel it. Pigsy's gone, and he gets these, like, physical symptoms, his ears burning, eyes twitching.
Proper bad omens. He's worried.
He is, but it shows how much he relies on his disciples. Right, even Pigsy, they're his security blanket in a way.
But his main worry, initially anyway, isn't, oh no, is Pigsy okay? It's more logistical.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. He's like, oh dear, if we lose him out here in the mountains, how will we ever find each other? It's not like it's a town.
Bless his heart.
Yeah.
Still thinking like a monk on a slightly inconvenient road trip. Not someone surrounded by demons.
It really shows his perspective, doesn't it? Focused on the quest, maybe a bit sheltered from the gritty reality sometimes.
And then Monkey steps in.
He figures, look, if there was a real monster, a dangerous one.
Pigsy would already be back here, screaming his head off with some wild story. Monkey knows him.
So Monkey's solution, not some big rescue plan.
Nope. Just tells Tripitaka basically, spur the horse on a bit, we'll catch up to the slowpoke.
Classic Monkey. Action-oriented, let's just keep moving.
Love it. Meanwhile, back at the demon cave.
Yeah.
Goldhorn's maybe having second thoughts.
A little bit, yeah. Maybe a demonic intuition. He tells Silverhorn, go back out, make sure we didn't somehow miss Tripitaka.
Good thinking for a demon lord. Keep your eye on the prize.
So Silverhorn heads out again, and this is where we learn about his special skill.
Ah, the cloud spotting. He can see auspicious clouds, Xiangyin, above good people.
Exactly. Like a glowing aura for good guys, and presumably like a dark smog for bad guys.
Wow. And the other demons, they can't see this.
Nope. Just him. It makes him their top tracker, basically. It's not just about strength for him. He's got this unique perception.
Sets him apart. So he uses this goodness detector.
Pretty much. And bingo. The demon points him out, and Tripitaka keeps shivering, getting these cold flashes.
And as he focuses on Tripitaka, the monk feels it again. More chills.
Oh, yeah. Multiple times.
And Xandy. What's his take on Tripitaka shivering?
Sandy offers the most mundane explanation possible. Master, you probably just ate something that didn't agree with you.
Haha.
So seeing his master is still uneasy, Monkey decides a little demonstration is in order.
Show, don't just tell. He whips out his staff.
And puts on quite a display, twirling it, showing off his skills. He even references ancient military classics.
The six strategies and three tactics. What's that about?
Otao San Lui. Yeah, these are foundational texts on Chinese military strategy, like Sun Tzu, but different traditions, attributed to figures like Zhang Ziya.
So Monkey's not just showing off fighting moves.
No, he's signaling mastery. He's saying, I don't just have brute strength, I have strategy. I know how to handle this. It's meant to reassure Tripitaka on multiple levels.
And does it work?
Oh, absolutely. Tripitaka is completely blown away. Thinks Monkey's skill is basically unparalleled in the entire world.
Tripitaka is just in awe.
Total reliance. Meanwhile, guess who's watching this whole performance?
Silverhorn, up on the ridge.
Yep. And his reaction. Utter terror.
Really? He's scared.
Genuinely terrified. He basically says, wow, everything I heard about this Monkey King, it's true. He's fearsome.
So the reputation precedes him, and the reality lives up to it.
Big time. But his little demon followers, they didn't get the memo.
They didn't see the fancy staff work. Or they just don't get it.
They just see one guy, however skilled, and think, hey, there are loads of us. Let's just rush him. They actually call their boss a coward.
Oh, bad move. Underestimating monkey is never smart.
Silverhorn knows it, though. This is where he gets really interesting. He thinks, okay, monkey's got the strength of 10,000 men.
My little troop here, we don't stand a chance.
Exactly. He makes a very clear-headed assessment of the situation. This isn't just a mindless brute.
He's got brains. So direct attack is off the table.
Right. He realizes they cannot take Tripitaka by force. Can't take him viciously or wickedly.
So what's the alternative?
Deception. Cunning. He decides on a whole new strategy.
Which is?
Get this. Befriend Tripitaka. Play nice. Gain his trust.
Seriously? A demon wants to be friends with the monk?
Well, not really friends. It's strategic.
Yeah.
Go kindly. Move him. Earn his heart so it aligns with mine. From that kindness, devise a plan to get him. Whoa.
It's a long con. It's surprisingly subtle for a demon we just saw getting ready for a fight.
And pretty insightful about Tripitaka, banking on his compassion.
Totally. He figures the monk's a soft touch, basically.
And he doesn't want Goldhorn knowing about this little scheme yet.
Nope. Tells the other demons, you guys head back. Don't tell the boss about this. I've got a plan.
Mm-hmm.
He's going rogue.
Taking initiative. Okay, so how does he kick off Operation Befriend the Monk?
With a disguise. A classic move.
What does he turn into?
An old Taoist priest. But not just any old priest. One with a badly broken leg.
Playing the sympathy card hard.
Absolutely. The description's great. Shiny hat, messy white hair, fancy robe, the whole look.
Ah, see da. Yeah, all the details. Bright eyes, looks basically healthy apart from the leg.
And there are these comparisons, right?
Oh.
Better than a Kinyu Taoist, stronger than a vegetarian scholar.
Yeah, little cultural nods to paint a picture. Makes him seem authentic, venerable, but definitely injured and non-threatening.
So the disguise is convincing.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
then he starts yelling for help. Juren, Juren, save me, help me.
Right into Tripitaka's compassionate earshot. It's a perfect setup.
Expertly played.
He kind of opens the door for manipulation.
Which is exactly what happens next with this mysterious Taoist.
Oh, yeah. And what an entrance he makes.
Right. This strange figure literally crawls out of the bushes.
Crawls out, bowing like crazy, weeping, saying he's hurt.
The description really lays it on thick. The apparent age, the frailty.
Coolly plays it up.
And the Tang Monk. His sympathy just goes into overdrive. He jumps off his horse immediately to help this poor old religious guy.
That theatricality, it's so important.
Yeah.
The exaggerated weakness, the pain, classic stuff to lower defenses, play on that empathy.
We see it all the time, don't we? Vulnerability as a disguise.
Yeah. In stories, even in life.
And then comes the story, really carefully put together.
Oh, yeah, the backstory.
He says he was traveling from a monastery nearby, the Usempi, did some ritual for someone south of the mountain.
Specific details.
Then, boom, a tiger attacks. Carries off his disciple, he says. And while running away, he falls, hurts his leg. It's this whole chain of awful events.
He's designed to pull the heartstrings, right? Make him seem credible.
And to top it off, he offers to... basically sell himself into servitude, Oshtu, to repay any kindness. And the Tang Monk. He's completely, utterly convinced. His response is just beautiful, really.
So simple.
He says, look, you and I, we're the same deep down. I'm a monk, you're a Taoist, our clothes are different. But our path, our practice, it's the same principle.
Emphasizing that shared humanity.
So helping isn't just being nice, it's living his beliefs.
Hmm.
And then the practical problem is the guy can't walk. The Tang Monk suggests Sandy carry the Taoist. And the Taoist flat out refuses.
Yeah.
Vehemently.
Yeah, that's a flag right there.
He says he's still terrified from the tiger. Okay. But then he says Sandy's face, his face, basically his unlucky looking face, scares him even more. And then Monkey steps in, the great fixer, the Tang Monk, trying to smooth it over, asks Monkey to carry the guy instead.
Okay.
And here's the really interesting bit. Monkey says yes immediately, and the Taoist accepts just as fast, no complaints at all.
We get Monkey's internal thoughts. He immediately tags the guy as a nasty demon, instantly suspicious.
No hesitation.
He's thinking, who does this old faker think he is trying to trick me? He knows the demon's after his master. And then Monkey has this darkly funny thought while carrying this demon.
He thinks basically... hey, demon, if you're planning on eating my master, you better save me a good slice.
Uh-huh.
So the Taoist, of course, denies it. I'm not a monster. I'm from a good family. Became a priest.
The usual denials.
But Monkey's not letting it go. He hits him with this killer question, like a logical trap.
Okay.
He asks, if you're so scared of tigers, why didn't you recite the Bei Du Jing? So the Bei Du Jing, the Northern Dipper scripture, it's a Taoist text. Yeah. You recite it for protection, right? Against evil, bad luck, danger, like yeah. tigers.
Okay, got it.
But the Tang monk, he actually scolds Monkey, quotes this powerful Buddhist saying, saving one life brings more merit than building a 7-story pagoda.
Wow.
Monkey's internal reaction to the scolding is priceless, too. He thinks his master is good on the outside, but muddled, lacking judgment on the inside. So he agrees to keep carrying the demon, but he lays down some conditions.
Conditions for carrying a demon.
Oh, yeah. And they're pretty funny. It's mostly about personal hygiene.
You're kidding.
Nope. He basically tells the demon, don't you dare pee or poop on my back and stain my nice clean clothes.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, the journey goes on like this. Precarious, right? Monkey carrying a demon he knows is a demon.
The Tang monk walking ahead, totally trusting.
And Sandy probably still fuming about being judged for his looks.
What an image. Wukong is not happy about this.
No, definitely not. And he's actually thinking, maybe I should just ditch him here. Complaining that walking without a burden is tiring enough. You really feel his frustration.
And this is where the bad guy shows his cunning. Because the text says this Taoist isn't just some old man.
Yeah.
He's a monster. And he knows what Wukong is thinking. He can even, like, use magic to counter those thoughts.
Whoa, okay. Mind games right from the start.
Exactly. The psychological thing, too.
So just as Wukong's thinking about making a run for it, bam, the monster hits him with the first big surprise. And it is big.
Oh, yeah. He uses magic, summons Mount Sumeru, and just, like, hurls it right at Wukong.
And Mount Sumeru isn't just any mountain, is it?
No, no. It's central in Buddhist cosmology. Kind of the axis of the world, represents immense scale, immense importance. So this first attack really sets the bar high.
You'd think that'd be it, wouldn't you? Game over.
Right.
But Wukong just sort of tilts his head, and this massive, cosmically important mountain just lands on his left shoulder.
It's incredible.
And his reaction, he basically jokes about it, says it's awkward carrying an uneven load. He even makes this comment about preferring things balanced.
But yeah, the monster sees this.
And he's not put off.
Well, he's shocked, but not deterred. He thinks, okay, one mountain wasn't enough. Let's try two.
So next up is Mount Imai, another huge, famous peak.
Yep. Summons it, throws it. And Wukong, again, just shifts it, puts this one on his right shoulder.
So now he's got two massive mountains, one on each shoulder, like giant epaulets or something, and he's still trying to catch up to his master.
It's insane. And the monster's reaction now, the text says he breaks out in a cold sweat. He's terrified.
Finally realizing what he's dealing with.
Absolutely. He's like, he can carry mountains. It's this moment of pure shock.
But the monster isn't quite done yet. He's got one more trick. He unleashes Mount Tai.
Another major one.
But this time, it's different. He uses a specific technique, like a downward crushing force. He's not just dropping it. He's actively trying to squash Wukong.
The text describes Wukong feeling weak, his tendons going numb.
Ooh.
Yeah, the pressure is so intense, it says he's sweating blood from, like, everywhere, all his orifices. This third mountain, with that crushing magic, it finally pins him down.
So while Wukong's literally under mountains of pressure, the monster targets the rest of the group.
Exactly. The scene shifts. We see Tang, Zanzang, and Xiaomonk. Monster drops down from the clouds, tries to grab the master.
But Xiaomonk jumps in.
He does. Drops the luggage instantly, grabs his staff, and goes right at the monster. No hesitation.
And the fight sounds pretty epic.
Oh, yeah. The description is great. Monster's got this 7-star sword. Xiaomonk has his demon-quelling staff. There's talk of golden light flashing.
Wow.
It contrasts the monster's fierce look with Xiaomonk's determination, his iron face. He's really giving it his all to protect the master.
Even though he's probably outmatched.
Oh, definitely. The description mentions, like, cloud spitting, dust flying. It's a big magical and physical clash.
Mm-hmm.
But despite Xiaomonk's bravery, his resolve.
It's not enough.
No. The monster's just too skilled with that sword, too relentless. He eventually gets past Xiaomonk's defense.
Oh, man. So Xiaomonk goes down.
Yeah, sadly. He's defeated. The monster disarms him, captures him super fast, then grabs Tang Sanzang. And get this, he even hooks the luggage with his foot and holds the horse's reins in his teeth.
Talk about multitasking. Efficient evil.
Right, and the text mentions this capturing method he uses. Doesn't really explain it, but sounds like some quick magic to grab and transport them all.
So yeah, grabs everyone, grabs the stuff.
The whole lot. Takes him straight to his lair, the Lotus Flower Caves. and he's shouting triumphantly to his brother that he's caught the monks, very pleased with himself. But the elder demon looks, and he's, like, skeptical. He asks, are you sure that's actually Tang Sanzang?
Oh, interesting. The elder one's more cautious.
Way more cautious. The younger one's all bluster. He's like, yeah, yeah, I got Tang Sanzang. But then he admits, but Sun Wukong, he's still out there.
Ah.
The elder demon gets it immediately. He knows Wukong is the real threat. He understands capturing the master is only step one. You have to deal with Wukong.
And he spells it out, right? Says they can't eat Tang Sanzang yet.
Exactly. He's like, hold on. We need to capture Wukong first. He's genuinely afraid Wukong will come after them with all his magic and transformations. He knows what Wukong is capable of.
But the younger brother just blows it off.
Completely. He's way too arrogant. Says something like, nah, he's finished. Those three mountains took care of him. The elder demon hears Wukong is under the mountains, and he's, like, relieved.
Mm.
Okay, maybe he is dealt with.
So Tang Sanzang looks like an easy meal now.
That's what they think. They start celebrating, ordering wine, planning to grab Pigsy too, lock everyone up. They're already counting their chickens. But even though the elder demon seems relieved, there's still a bit of doubt, maybe.
Mm.
He still wants a foolproof way to make sure Wukong is captured, even under the mountains.
He understands Wukong better than his brother does.
Definitely. But the younger one, still full of himself, suggests this really simple plan. They don't even have to leave the cave.
Lazy villains. What's the plan?
It involves magic treasures.
Of course.
The younger demon has this purple gold red gourd.
Mm-hmm.
The elder has a jade pure bottle.
Okay, magical containers.
And apparently they're really powerful artifacts. The way they work is wild.
Oh, so.
You hold the gourd or the bottle upside down, call out the target's name.
Uh-huh.
And if they answer, whoosh, they get sucked right inside.
No.
Like a supernatural vacuum cleaner.
No way. That's convenient and deadly.
Oh, yeah. Once someone's trapped inside, they plan to stick this special decree from Lao Tzu on it. And that apparently just dissolves the victim instantly.
Yikes. Okay, so magical items trump brute strength again.
Seems to be the theme here, doesn't it? Wukong's strength is amazing, but these magical solutions seem almost effortless if they work.
So who do they send to use these things? Surely not the overconfident younger brother.
Nope. They delegate. They pick two minor demons. The names translate to something like Refined Ghost and Clever Bug.
Refined Ghost and Clever Bug. Okay.
Yeah. These two little guys get sent off with these incredibly powerful, dangerous items to go capture the mighty Sun Wukong. Shows the hierarchy, right? The bosses send the minions to do the risky work.
Okay. Scene change. Monkey King, Shu, is trapped.
Yeah. He's literally pinned under a mountain. He thinks of his master, Tang Sanzang.
He remembers being rescued himself back at the Two Realms Mountain. Then he starts reflecting on their connection, his bond with Sanzang. That line.
Mm-hmm. Living together, cultivating together, sharing destiny, sharing form, understanding knowledge.
He even considers that Tang Sanzang might die this time. He does have that line, he invited the demon, deserves to die. Like, the master made a mistake, maybe, but now they're all suffering for it.
Exactly. His companions are in danger because of this mess.
He worries about the others.
Yeah, Shaw Monk and Bigsy, even the Dragon Horse.
He pities them. He's usually so focused on his own power.
It shows a remarkable sense of responsibility, I think. Even when he's the one crushed under a mountain, his concern is for the team, for the mission.
So it reveals this deep loyalty.
Definitely. He feels the weight of their shared quest, even in his own despair.
And then he says that proverb.
Ah, yes. A tall tree catches the wind. A person of high reputation invites ruin. And it leads right into that raw emotion. His tears fall like rain.
Weeping. Okay, so while he's having these thoughts, some local deities show up.
Right, the mountain god and the earth deity.
Them, plus some bigger players, the five direction gods and this figure, the Jin Tuji.
The local spirits don't know the Monkey King is buried on their patch.
Nope. Completely clueless. But it takes the Jin Tuji to set them straight, and pretty sharply, too.
Oh, what does he say?
Basically points and says, that's Sun Wukong, the great sage who smashed up the heavenly palace 500 years ago.
Okay, so that gets their attention.
Oh, yeah. Instant panic stations. Suddenly they realize who they're dealing with.
And they're probably thinking about potential consequences if he gets out and finds out they were involved.
Definitely. They know his reputation. And the Jin Tuji kind of rubs it in, describing Wukong's weapon, that magic staff.
The Rui Jingu Bang.
That's the one. He says, basically, it's lethal. A direct hit kills, a glancing blow injures, a tap breaks bones, a scrape tears skin. The local gods are terrified now.
So what's their excuse for, you know, moving the mountain onto him in the first place?
Well, they try to pass the buck. They say, we just heard the demon use the mountain moving spell, so we moved the mountain. They claim the law says one is not punished for what one does not know. So, okay, eventually Wukong gets freed. But this is Wukong. First thing he says is, all right, you two, meaning the mountain and earth gods, stick out your ankles, two wax each to relieve my boredom. The deities are like, shocked. You promised you wouldn't hurt us. Good gods, you're not scared of me, old son, but you are scared of the demon.
Ooh.
And it also tells you something about this demon, right?
Yeah, that these local gods are genuinely terrified of him.
Utterly, and we find out why. They explain the demon uses spells to basically summon them to his case.
Summon them? Like servants?
Exactly. One of us has to be on duty each day taking turns. They're enslaved, forced labor for this demon.
Wow. Okay, so this demon isn't just tricky. He's got some serious power to be bossing around minor deities like that.
For sure. He's completely disrupted the local spiritual order. These guides are meant to be guardians, not gophers.
And how does Wukong react when he hears this? That these gods are being treated like slaves?
He is furious. Absolutely indignant. He gives this whole speech.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, basically saying, look, since creation, since I was born on Flower Fruit Mountain, learned magic, beat up tigers, smashed the heavens, called myself Great Sage, even I never treated the mountain and earth gods like this. How dare this demon call them slaves and make them work shifts? Heavens, why create me, Sun Wukong, and then also create scum like this? He's saying, yeah, I rebelled against the top dogs, but I never abused the little guys like this. He sees it as fundamentally wrong, a violation. Then suddenly there's this glowing light from the demon's cave.
The light?
Yeah. The earth deity says, oh, that's the demon's treasure.
And Wukong's reaction.
Predictably, oh, this looks like fun. His curiosity just takes over immediately.
Of course it does. Treasure. Adventure. Classic Wukong.
And then the earth deity gives him a really key piece of intel about the demon.
What's that?
He says the demon loves alchemy and making elixirs, and he really likes Taoist priests.
Uh-huh. Didn't this demon trick Tang Sanzang earlier by disguising himself as an old Taoist?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Wukong hears this, puts two and two together, and decides, okay, I'll handle this.
Time for some Monkey King action.
Pretty much. He tells the local gods to clear out, and then he transforms.
Into what?
Into an old Taoist priest himself. The text even describes the outfit, you know, hair in two knots, patched robe, fish drum, special sash, fighting fire with fire, or disguise with disguise.
Yep, he's going undercover. He settles down to wait for the lesser demons to come out. And when they show up, it's not some big dramatic fight.
No, not at all. He just trips him, sticks his staff out.
Well, down they go. It's almost like slapstick.
Kind of. Not exactly a heroic entrance, is it?
Definitely not. So they get up, obviously annoyed, a bit dusty, probably.
And they start grumbling. They complain, sure. But then they say something like, if our boss didn't respect your group, we wouldn't let this slide. So Monkey King, being Monkey King, he immediately tries to smooth it over. Fellow Taoists are all one family.
And then the even stranger part.
Yeah, the meeting money. He says they needed to fall down as meeting money for him. And the demons, they're not having it.
Not at all. They're like, meeting money! Our king wants silver, pal, not watching us trip.
And then they notice something else.
The accent.
You sound different. You're not from around here.
They challenge him, asking if he's really a local Taoist priest. They have some suspicion.
Where does he say he's from?
He goes big. He claims he's from Panglai Mountain. And interestingly, the demons themselves know it. They call it an island paradise of immortals.
Smart.
And then he doubles down with this incredibly bold line. You know, if I'm not an immortal, who is?
Okay, that probably did it, didn't it? That confidence must have swayed them.
It absolutely did. Their whole attitude flips. Suddenly, they're all respectful, calling him old immortal and apologizing for, you know, bumping into him.
It really shows how just, like, asserting yourself can change everything.
Definitely. Perceptions shift fast.
All right, so he's got their respect.
He gives them a reason for being there. He says he's looking for a good person on the mountain, someone he can take away to become an immortal.
Oh, I bet their ears perked up at that.
Instantly. Both of them, so Atua, they jump at the chance. Master, I'll go with you. Both volunteer immediately.
Ah, of course they do. easy path to immortality, right?
Exactly what they think.
And Wukong just plays dumb at this point.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't know anything about them.
Pretty much. He acts all innocent, asking, oh, where are you guys from? Where are you heading? Standard questions.
And that's when they spill the beans.
That's the moment. They reveal they're from the Lotus Flower Cave No, and crucially, that their kings sent them to capture Sun Wukong. He asks, could it be that Sun Wukong, the one escorting Tang Monk? And they confirm, yep, that's the monkey they're after. He says something like, Nov, that monkey is quite rude. I know him, and actually I'm pretty annoyed with him too. And then offers to help them catch him. By pretending to be on their side against himself, he completely lowers their guard.
Exactly. So they spill the beans pretty quickly. They reveal, and they've got these interesting magical items. The red gourd, jade bottle. He asks to see them, to examine these amazing treasures.
And the demons, given how dangerous these things are.
They just hand them over. It shows how naive they are, really.
Yeah.
Completely fooled by the old priest disguise.
Unbelievable. So Wukong has them in his hands. Does he just run?
He thinks about it. The text mentions him considering just stealing them daylight robbery.
But he doesn't. Why not?
His reputation, apparently. Or maybe just his style.
Yeah.
He prefers outsmarting them, you know, trickery over theft.
Okay, so instead of stealing...
He makes a counteroffer. A brilliant move. He says, basically, your treasures are okay, but let me show you mine. So he performs a bit of magic.
The classic Wukong magic.
Plucks a hair from his tail.
Yeah.
You know, standard procedure for him, and transforms it.
Into what?
Into this impressive-looking gourd. A large purple gold one. About 1'7" long, the text specifies. He presents it like, here, look at my gourd. They look at their own treasures, which they boast can hold thousands, and they call Wukong's gourd useless. It can't possibly compare to their magical items, they think.
And this is where Wukong lays the trap.
Oh, yeah. He makes the most outrageous claim. He says his gourd, it can you.
It can what now?
Hold the sky.
Hold the sky. Seriously.
Seriously. That's his claim. You can imagine the demons just staring. They're like, prove it. He says, oh, yeah, I capture the sky all the time. Depends on the weather, you know. Sometimes once or twice a month, sometimes more.
He's just making it up as he goes along, but with such confidence.
That's the key. The sheer audacity delivered so casually, it kind of throws them off. They start thinking, well, because the next thing you know, the clever bug gets an idea.
Uh-oh.
He proposes a trade. They're two genuine puss-making treasures.
Yeah.
For Wukong's one, probably just a hair. Sky-holding gourd.
No way!
Yes way.
And Wukong must be internally celebrating.
Oh, absolutely. The text says he thinks one for two, that's a great deal. Wukong just plays along super casual, like, oh, you guys serious? You want to trade for my sky catcher?
And the demon, that clever bug, he seals his fate with this incredible boast. He says, yeah, if it can hold the sky, it's a deal.
So Wukong gets a message directly to the Day Guardian. The Night Guardian, and the five directional deities.
Yeah.
He essentially tells them, listen up, I need to borrow the sky for about half an hour.
Borrow the sky.
To make this exchange with the demons work. And, he adds, if you don't cooperate, I'm taking my grievances straight to the top, to the Jade Emperor himself, and starting a war. They probably think, uh-oh, he might actually do it.
So this message gets up the chain to the Jade Emperor. How does he react? I imagine he's not thrilled.
Understandably, he's a bit taken aback. The text says he calls Sun Wukong a Puyotu, an impudent monkey.
Yeah, sounds about right from the emperor's perspective.
Yeah, and he kind of mutters to himself, remembering that Guan Yin recommended this monkey for the journey and that he himself sent deities to protect Tang Sanzang.
And then he asks the obvious question.
Right, his immediate thought is, can the sky even be packed? Which, you know, is a perfectly logical question.
From a conventional perspective, it seems utterly impossible. The Jade Emperor represents that established order.
He finds the whole idea inherently absurd. However, what's interesting is how the narrative then introduces this element of flexibility or maybe pragmatism within this celestial structure.
Ah, because someone steps up.
Exactly. Enter Neza. Yeah, Neza, the third Lotus Prince.
Neza, okay, a major player. And he supports this crazy idea.
Surprisingly, yes. He steps in and essentially says, actually, Emperor, you know, helping Sun Wukong with this, it might be a worthwhile endeavor.
Wow. Talk about an unexpected ally. What's his reasoning?
Well, Nezha offers a more nuanced viewpoint. He acknowledges, yeah, okay, technically the sky is boundless, pure ki, difficult to actually contain.
Right.
But he argues assisting Sun Wukong's mission, which is fundamentally righteous, protecting Tang Sanzang, is a worthy cause. He frames it like, this is a great opportunity for good karma, basically. Let's help him succeed.
So it's less about the literal possibility and more about the purpose behind it.
Precisely. And Nezha doesn't just support the idea. He offers a practical solution.
Okay, this is what I want to know. How do they do it?
His solution is pure brilliance. Forget actually trying to cram the sky into a gourd or something.
Yeah, good luck with that.
He proposes borrowing the black carved banner, the Zaodiao Qi, from the deity Zenwu at the northern heavenly gate.
A banner? What does that do?
They'll take this banner and display it down at the southern heavenly gate. And this specific banner has the power to block out all celestial light, the sun, the moon, the stars.
So it creates the illusion of darkness, like an artificial eclipse.
Exactly. It's not about packing the sky. It's about creating the effect of the sky being gone, plunged into darkness. That's the key distinction.
That is clever. A very neat workaround.
It's the true ingenuity, right? It meets Sun Wukong's needs without requiring a literal impossibility.
Okay, so the plan is set. The Jade Emperor presumably agrees.
Well, with Nez's backing and the logic presented, he seems to go along with it. So things move fast. The Day Guardian immediately zips down and informs Sun Wukong, help is on the way. Nez is coming.
And Sun Wukong, ever the performer, starts his part of the show.
Oh, yeah. He immediately pretends to start casting some grand spell. He makes a big show of it, and then he tosses up this gourd.
The gourd he's going to pack the sky in.
Well, a fake gourd. It's actually just one of his hairs, transformed. You know how he does that?
Ah, classic Monkey King trick.
And the detail here is great. The hair gourd is incredibly light. It just sort of floats down slowly, carried by the wind. It takes about half an hour to fall.
Half an hour? Ah, that's the time he asked for.
Exactly. This creates the necessary delay. It gives Nezha time to get the banner, fly to the southern gate, and deploy it, all while making it look like Sun Wukong's sky packing spell is slowly taking effect.
Brilliant timing. So Nezha gets the banner.
He does. He unfurls the black carved banner, and bam, instant darkness. The description in the text is so vivid. Truly, the universe was dyed with ink, the cosmos stained with indigo. It just paints this picture of complete, sudden, unnatural night.
That must have been terrifying and incredibly convincing for anyone on the ground.
Absolutely. This dramatic, immediate shift in the environment is what sells the illusion. The sudden, total darkness provides the perfect sensory evidence the demons need to believe Sun Wukong's a completely outlandish claim.
And the demons, how do they react?
They are utterly, completely bewildered. The text has them saying, wait a minute. We were just talking and it was noon. How has it suddenly become dusk?
They're totally disoriented, questioning their own senses.
Their confusion stems directly from their reliance on normal sensory input, right? The abrupt darkness just shatters their understanding of time and their immediate reality.
Which makes them highly susceptible to suggestion.
Extremely susceptible. And Sun Wukong plays it flawlessly. The sky's been packed. You can't tell the time anymore.
Oh my God.
And of course, it's dark. I've got the sun, the moon, and all the stars packed away in here. He just doubles down on the absurdity with, you imagine, a perfectly straight face.
He's good. He's really good.
His explanations, while completely illogical if you think about it, create this twisted kind of sense within the context of their altered perception. He's expertly leveraging their fear and confusion to totally control the narrative.
And then he takes it even further, right? He doesn't just stop at darkness.
No, he ramps up the psychological pressure. They can only hear him in the pitch blackness. They can't see anything. So he tells them they're standing right on the very edge of the Bohai Sea.
The Bohai Sea, like the ocean.
Yeah, and that they're about to fall into a bottomless abyss any second.
That's just cruel, but incredibly effective, I bet.
Masterful manipulation. It significantly amplifies their fear. Not only is their reality warped by this impossible night, but now they face this immediate, terrifying physical threat.
So they're completely panicked.
This heightened state of anxiety makes them desperate and far more willing to comply with whatever Sun Wukong demands to make it stop.
So completely freaked out by the packed sky and the non-existent cliff edge, the demons finally agree to the swap.
They cave. They hand over their precious treasures, the gourd that can suck people in, and the jade bottle, the Jingping.
Wow, it worked. The whole crazy plan actually worked.
The exchange itself just highlights how effective Sun Wukong's elaborate deception was. The demons are willing to part with these incredibly powerful, valuable items, all driven by fear and the belief that they're dealing with someone who can literally control the heavens.
But Sun Wukong isn't quite finished yet, is he? There's more trickery involved.
He can't resist one last flourish. He gives them the fake gorgeous, the transformed hair, which probably feels ridiculously light compared to what they gave him.
They don't notice, or they're too scared to care.
Probably too scared and disoriented. Then, in this final act, he plucks another hair, transforms it into a copper coin,
okay,
and tells one of the smaller demons nearby,
yeah,
go buy some paper.
Paper? In the middle of this, why?
He claims he wants to draw up a contract to formalize the exchange.
Contract? For trading the sky? This is getting absurd.
It adds this layer of almost comical bureaucracy to the whole situation. Sun Wukong is pretending to legitimize this utterly bizarre transaction, trading a treasure for storing people for his supposed treasure for storing the sky.
It's another manipulation, isn't it? To make the whole thing seem more real, more official in their terrified minds.
Exactly. It reinforces the validity of the exchange. But of course, the demons point out, it's pitch black. We're on the edge of an abyss. There's no pen and ink here.
Good point. So no contract.
It suggests making a vow instead, a solemn oath.
Okay, what do they swear?
And they agree on a pretty serious curse. If either side goes back on the deal, they'll suffer from horrible plagues in all four seasons.
Yikes. That's a heavy vow for a deal based on a complete lie.
It provides that sense of finality, that binding agreement, even without the paper. Both parties, well, the demons at least, believe they've secured a legitimate, albeit terrifying, exchange.
So, treasures now in hand, vow sworn. Sun Wukong makes his getaway.
Swiftly. He's got what he came for. He leaps up, presumably towards the heavens, straight to the southern heavenly gate where Nezha is holding the banner.
Does he thank Nezha?
He does. He expresses his gratitude for the essential banner assistance. It wasn't a solo effort, and he acknowledges that.
Nezha!
Nezha takes the banner back to Zenwu at the northern gate. Mission accomplished. Celestial property returned. A remarkably efficient, if utterly bizarre, operation, all things considered.
Wow, what a sequence.
It concludes with Sun Wukong, now safely up in the sky, looking down and observing the utterly bewildered demons still stuck in the dark.
Setting up the next part of the story, you assume he's probably not just going to leave them there forever.
Exactly. It leaves us hanging, wondering what his next move will be now that he has the treasures he needed.